How were you treated by the professors at Willamette Law School and by your fellow, literally fellow law students?
Well, I don't ever remember any feeling of discrimination at all, none at all, except in one instance in law school. And this was my last year when I was taking 20 hours, and I had this small baby, and there was a professor from California, new kid on the block there that was teaching constitutional law, which I got an A in, and also teaching the second half of the legal reading and legal research program. And the system was then that if you were a second year law student, you could not graduate until you had participated in the moot court competition. And that required you to write a brief on a given subject, and then after the brief was prepared, required you to argue it and go up the steps, the elimination steps. And he must have known that I was a good and able student because he was taught constitutional law, and I got an A from him in constitutional law. But when it came time for the oral argument, I turned in my brief on the side of the argument that was assigned to me. I turned it in, I went into him, and I said, "May I be excused from the oral argument part?" Which made it difficult because I had a babysitter in the morning, but I didn't have in the afternoon, and these arguments took place in the afternoon. So I went to him and I said, "I'm graduating in June, and if I won this," which was the second year course, "I wouldn't be here to represent Willamette Law School in the regional competition or the national competition." Now, that was not far-fetched because just the year before, the Willamette student had won the national competition. And I remember he laughed when I said that. And he said, "Well, there's not much likelihood of that, Mrs. Paulus." And he said, "Everyone must at least go through one oral argument, and I'm not going to excuse you from it." Well, I can remember, that's the only time I ever remember being really mad. And I was very angry, and I walked out of there and I thought, "Okay, Buster, if that's the way you want it, that's the way you're going to get it." Well, I won the moot court competition. Then he had the audacity to ask me, because I was so very good at it, to delay my graduation for a year so I could represent Willamette in the regional and national tournaments. So there was some satisfaction in that.
Once you determined to finish law school, what did you hope to do with your degree?
Well, by then I was pregnant with my second child, and I don't know what I don't remember thinking about that. I worked for the Supreme Court in writing synopses of briefs at home when we lived on 14th Street when my children were babies. And then I started working as an appellate lawyer. And I did that because I could do it at home, or I could do it at my own leisure. It's not like having customers or clients that you have to respond to. And I did that with success until finally one day Wally Carson, whose family had had the law firm next to where I first started working in the Pioneer Trust Company, he and I had graduated from law school together, and he came to me and said, I want to run for the legislature, and would you help me? Would you be on my committee?" And Bill and I thought that I should do that. So I became involved in politics. I'd been involved in a minor way in school budget issues, but nothing really political, because all the time I was in law school, I didn't have time to think about anything. I was either working and studying, or working, studying, and pregnant, or keeping my house and my family and studying. So I really didn't have any time for extracurricular thought or extracurricular activity during that period of my life.
Did you have help with your family?
Well,
household help?
No, the only help that I had was when I was going to law school. I had a Mormon lady that came in every morning and kept care of Elizabeth. But.
Amazing. So what kind of experience did you gain while you were working for Wally Carson?
Well, I found I was really good at it. As a matter of fact, by the time we'd finished his campaign, most of the stuff that is now used in political campaigns came from the stuff that Wally and I and David Roten did then. So Wally's election was an enormous success. It was the best campaign that this county had seen and, well, ever seen. And that kind of gave me a reputation then. So I had other people asking me to do the same thing. And I remember that Packwood was elected to the House of Representatives, and I remember he called me several times and asked me to be his secretary. And I remembered being insulted by that and thinking to myself, if I ever go down to the State House, I'll be going under my own steam. Interestingly enough, the woman that did go to work for him is my secretary, Ann Lau.
Who or what made you decide to run as a candidate yourself?
Well, then we worked on Wally's second campaign. And when the Senate seat opened up and he decided he was going to run for the Senate, I, by that time, had figured out that's what I was going to do.
And when did you have your opportunity?
Well, let's see, I ran in 1970.
And what kinds of issues did you concern yourself with at that time?
Well, I was very involved in all of the livability environmental issues. Interestingly enough, when I told Wally that I was going to run, he told me that I couldn't get elected. And the biggest obstacle to my election in 1970 was the fact that I was a woman. And this county had only elected one other woman to the legislature in its history, and that was the year I was born, 1933. A woman still alive and lives here. Hannah Martin Hansen.
She might make a good oral history interview.
She would. She now is involved in senior citizen. She's a senior citizen activist, or she was when I was in the legislature. She would be. I think I've often wondered how she ever got elected. And the time she got elected, she would. I don't know that. I think Hannah was married to a Jew. I'm not sure about that. But I've often wondered how she got herself elected.
In what way was being a woman an obstacle, do you think?
Well, looking back on it, it wasn't so much that I was a woman, because this county had elected a woman as district attorney. But if you stop to think about it, the most significant factor of my election in 1976 was not that I was the first woman to be either treasurer or governor or secretary of state. They're really significant. Two of them were that I wasn't into politics on my husband's coattails, number one, which is the standard thing, like Maureen Neuberger. And the other thing, the really significant thing in 76, was that the people of this state elected a wife and a mother. For the first time, they said, yes, a woman can do the same thing that a husband and father can do. That's the really significant thing. They elect women that are divorced, elect women that are widowed, or elect single women. But the really basic fact of my election was that I had children and they were still at home.
I did at least one interview of a woman who was a mother when she was elected to mm-hmm. the legislature, and she said that the constituents were concerned about the children, what would happen to the children.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes.
And what did you tell them when they asked?
Well, I've usually told them about the story of, well, when the first time when I ran, that was the biggest obstacle, and it didn't come from the very poor people. It came from people my own socioeconomic class, and it didn't come from men, it came from women. Somehow I was threatening their role, and I remember a very a turning point in my career, of my campaign. We would always have coffees, and we'd try to have them in homes that people would come to see the house, even if they wouldn't come see me. And the hardest sell I had was women in my own socioeconomic class in this community, because they would come and listen very carefully to me, because they didn't know that I'd had such a hard scrabble background, as my husband calls it. And we live in a very nice house now, in a very nice neighborhood, and my husband's family was prominent here for years. So they'd come and listen to that rate with interest, and they'd come to see the house, but I'd always feel, well, I'm not getting through to them, why not? But I could go to the Lions Club, Kiwanis Club, Chamber of Commerce, and I'd know when I left there that those men were going to vote for me, because they knew I knew what I was talking about. So finally one day I'd had enough of that, and we had a huge gathering someplace, this coffee, and I have a friend whose name is also Norma, and was a nurse at the time, and her children were born at the same time as mine, and I said, you know, it's very interesting. I want to talk to you about something that's really bothering me. I said, why is it that you will tell this Norma it's all right for her to be a nurse, which takes just as much discipline, maybe more discipline, just as much time away from the family, as what I want to do? But you say it's all right for her to be a nurse, and you don't worry that her husband's going to run off and marry somebody else, or you don't worry that her children are going to turn to drug and pots. But when I stand up and say, let me be your legislator, and it would make it easier for, I'd be able to be home more, and my flex hours would be different than being a nurse on a standard shift. I said, I don't understand that. Why is it that you will let Norma, with the same family, the same background, everything else, it's all right for her to go out and be a nurse 8 hours a day, but it's not all right for me to be your legislator. That doesn't make sense to me. Why do you think that if you say, yes, Norma, you can be a legislator, that my family's going to disintegrate? I said, I don't think you're being fair to me. You're putting your own time constraints and your own sense of values and your own sense of what you want to be and imposing it on me, and that's not right. I said, I would be very good at being your legislator. Well, it must have sunk in, because, but that was before feminism caught on. I certainly wasn't a feminist at that point at all. I put other women down and thought, well, it was their own attitude that kept them where they were. But that really was still a factor until 1976. I have people say, I'd go into a school where the woman had been working since her kids were infants. And they'd say, well, what about your children? And I'd say, what about your children? I was home with mine until they went to school. You've been out in the workforce when they were 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. I was home with mine between 1 and 6. Oh, well, it's different. I said, well, how is it different? I don't understand it. It's different because I want to go to the Capitol or something? It threatened their own sense of value and what they were doing once I stepped out of that mold that they had placed on me. But that all changed very dramatically.
You said you weren't a feminist then. Do you consider yourself to be a feminist now?
Oh, yes. I am an ardent feminist. A lot of things happened to me once I got in the legislature that just made me turn myself inside and out. Oh, yes.
such as?
Well, I don't, as I said, when I was in law school, I really didn't experience any discrimination. And I'd have women come to me all the time that say, how do you manage to have such a handsome husband and two children, and you seem to be happy and functioning and still do what you do, which at that time was lawyering. And I, looking back on it, I'd always kind of put them down. But then a couple things happened. When I was running for the legislature, and it hit me right in the face that my sex was the greatest obstacle, that really angered me. But it took me a while to sort it out in my mind, to find out really where I was coming from. Then, on the day that I filed in March, Bill and I were taking our kids to Victoria for spring, their little spring break. And as we were waiting to get on the ferry boat, I bought a copy of Atlantic, and it was all devoted to feminism, Atlantic, the magazine. Mm-hmm. And in there, I read an article by Catherine Drinker Bowen, the biographer. Mm-hmm. And on the ferry boat, I read that. And essentially what she said is that the, quote, professional woman, the woman who has made it in the so-called male-dominated professions, are the biggest albatross around the women's movement's neck. Because she doesn't want other women to do what she does. And I thought to myself, my God, she's certainly talking about me. And I really had to look at myself, and I think that's the first time I did. And I thought, I don't want other women to become lawyers or run for the legislature because it would destroy my own uniqueness, my own separateness, the thing that makes me stand out, that makes me a curiosity. That was a very real turning point in my own personal philosophy, was reading that article. But up until that time, people asked me if I'd read Feminine Mystique. Oh, well, I couldn't be bothered. And then... After I was elected, the only time that ever really hit me was one day when I was carrying a bill on the floor of the House, and another lawyer, who is a close personal friend of mine, was arguing on the other side of it. And when we sat down, he sent me a note and he said, you really sounded bitchy. And I went over to him and I said, if you didn't like my response, why didn't you take me on? And he said, oh, I couldn't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, well, I wouldn't want to humiliate you. That would put me in a bad light. And, of course, what he was saying is that he was so skilled in the art of debate, and we were friends and he liked me, that he didn't want to humble me because, obviously, he would be able to just rip me apart. Well, that made me so mad for him to assume that I couldn't handle myself. And it wouldn't be an equal foray, an equal intellectual argument. That just really pissed me off. I can remember just being outraged, and that was in 1971. And then in 70, in between the 71 and 73 session, I was invited to a meeting at the Myron Frank, or something called the Oregon Women's Political Caucus. And I went to it simply because I went to anything that I was invited to as a legislator. If there were four chicken pluckers having a convention at Four Corners and I was invited, I was there because I felt that was part of the contract. So I went on a Saturday morning down to the tea room at Myron Frank and met Gretchen Kifori. And I remember thinking to myself, boy, if this isn't a ragtag outfit, I've never seen one. And I suppose it was Gretchen, more than any other single individual, that really helped me turn the corner on feminism.
Did you have any trouble when you were in the legislature being taken seriously then?
No, I think largely I went in, and if you have a law degree and people find out that you have a law degree and you've never been to college, it gives you an instant credibility, at least for brains. And then I didn't come in with a passel of bills. I came down here thinking, I'll find out what the issues are and do my homework. And I was careful not to speak on the floor unless I had something really important to say. I didn't pop up and down like a lot of freshmen do. But no, I think I earned credibility very quickly. And in the 6 years that I was in the legislature, I was involved in almost every major controversy and carried major legislation. And there was only once that a bill I carried did not pass, and I got it passed the second time, the second day. No, I never felt that at all.
I should have asked you this earlier on, but why did you join the Republican Party in the first place?
Well, I was a Democrat. When I was in Burns, I remember doing a little bit of Adlai Stevenson. There were campaigns over there, but I remember being very enamored with Adlai Stevenson. And I was still a Democrat when I was working for Wally. But the more I got involved in the local political scene, the more I thought, at that period of the time, the Democratic response to everything was to have the federal government do it. And that just simply didn't fit in with my own background. And the work ethic and to do it yourself was so instilled in me that it seemed like no matter what I was involved with in Salem or Marion County, the response was to try to get the federal government to do it. And I just felt things should be closer at home. So I suppose that plus working so hard to get Wally elected as a Republican, and I switched my registration. And I've always stayed that way.
Which pieces of legislation that you worked on are you most proud of?
Well, I think the most satisfying legislative experience I ever had was serving on the very prestigious Criminal Law Revision Commission. And it was a statutory committee with Tony Uturi and John Burns and Jim Burns and Harl Haas and Wally Carson, Herb Schwab, Bruce Spaulding, people like that. And we were charged with revising Oregon's criminal code, which had not been revised for 100 years. And after that task was completed and we got it past the legislature, and aspects of it were extremely controversial, some of which I carried the obscenity statutes and things like that. I think that was the most satisfying experience I had because it was totally devoid of partisanship. And I was dealing with some of the best legal minds in the state and that took their task very seriously. And there was an intellectual capacity and drive about it that is missing in most legislative committees. But all the environmental legislation that I worked so hard on, and women's issues, and the Criminal Law Revision Commission's work.
Which do you think were your most difficult in the legislature to deal with? Which issues?
The only time I ever lost sleep over any vote was not something I was carrying, but just something I was voting on. as a committee member. And that was legislation that made it easier for the court to terminate parental rights. I think that's the one that I think was the most troubling and had the most far-reaching effects.
Who were some of the other women who were present in the legislature when you were there, and how did you work with those women?
Well, Mary Reakey was a great source of inspiration to me. Mary was so pure politically on the issues that she was really quite extraordinary. And of course, Betty Roberts and Nancy Fadley, Mary Burroughs, Gretchen and Vera, of course. Vera was wonderful to be involved in with Vera, and principally in the 73 session. It was when she was still very brash.
Did the women work together on any specific issues?
In 73, I went to Betty Roberts, and the Democrats controlled then, and of course she was our senior. And I suggested to her that if the Republican and Democratic women held together on issues that affected women, that neither party had enough numerical strength to do without our votes on crucial issues. And so Betty started the Women's Caucus. And in 73 and 75, we worked very closely. And that was a very, very satisfying, rewarding experience. That same solidarity does not exist and has not, principally in the last two sessions.
Why do you think that is?
Well, there are women in the legislature that are not committed to the feminist cause. And the other reason is, which is particularly difficult for me to accept, is that some of the women that have come in now don't want to pay their dues. They assume that it's always been that way and there's no reason to stick together.
Why did you decide in 1976 to seek the office of Secretary of State?
Well, for a couple of reasons, principally because the Democrats control both houses, so it was obvious to anybody that it wouldn't be possible to be Speaker or President of the Senate.